And let's get started. Here we go. All right. So today's topic is, well, it's actually two topics, kind of. There is the ALS method, and there is the Spark environment. And of course, Spark is yet another, let me open the chat real quick. Okay. So Spark is, of course, yet another tool, and it's of course not required for this course to learn, but they have a quite nice implementation of many of these recommender systems. And the reason behind that is a bit, so Spark is a computing environment. It's kind of built a little bit in the way that the old school Hadoop was built. So it's really focused on distributed computing. So Spark is, you know, you can use it on your laptop, and I'll tell you a little bit on how you get it to run on your laptop, but that's not really the way it's meant to be used. So the typical use of Spark is, you know, you have a couple of terabyte data sets, you have a cluster of a couple of hundred machines, and you do machine learning and data analysis on that. And actually the real strength of Spark is that the syntax or the parallelism, the use of huge clusters, it's completely implicit in the environment. So the same code that runs on your laptop on a data set of a couple of hundred rows will run just as well on a 500 node Spark cluster. And that's really great because you can do a lot of experimenting and code development on your laptop, and then basically use these bigger compute resources when and if needed. In general, so sort of if you look at data sets and computers these days, so you know, you can rent compute nodes in Amazon with, I think the biggest that they have at the moment is 4 terabyte of RAM. So yeah, what a big data set is, this is of course all the time shifting. But you know, if you want to do really large scale machine learning, let's say, you know, you have ambitions to join one of the bigs, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Amazons, Spark is certainly a tool that you'll be using. To get Spark to run on your machine depends a little bit on the environment that you're on. I'm on a Mac, so I had to install both PySpark, and that's just your usual like pip install PySpark, so that's quite easy. But then you need Java. And you need Java because Spark is written in Scala, and Scala runs on the Java virtual machine. So that's why you need a Java runtime environment that you can just Google how to install that. And Spark is, so PySpark is just one of the interfaces into Spark. You can use Scala as well. And there's a Java interface and there's an R interface. And the R interface is the least mature. Python is always catching up a bit because of course the new implementations run. So the new implementations are done in Scala. And so you can then use them in Scala and in Java, of course. And then they get sort of ported up into Python. And we'll see one of the limitations today. So let me get rid of this and make the font a bit bigger. So the entry point here is PySpark SQL. And from that, we need the Spark session. And the Spark session is an object that can connect to either a local machine, or it can be used to connect sort of from your machine into a Spark cluster. And the easiest way to do this is a create function. So our Spark session shall be Spark session dot builder dot get or create. And on this builder, you can set all kinds of parameters and functions you know, tell it where to connect. But if you just call it like this without any parameters, without setting anything, what it will do is it will create a local instance of Spark to run on your laptop. And that's what you basically want. So typically when you load large data sets, they will be residing somewhere in a kind of network file system or somewhere. And typically when you do these kind of developments, you always need to think about memory sizes, how big are the data sets that you're actually working with. But for today, we'll use a relatively small data set. That's so the Oslo Bicycle has an open data initiative where you can, so this is just oslobicycle.no, and they give you historical trip data. And we'll use the June data set. And you can just download them here. But what we'll do is actually load this into Pandas. And that is very untypical. So typically you would not first load it into Pandas and then load it into Spark, because you know having it in Pandas basically implies that it fits on your local machine. So why would you do that, right? But it's just one of the ways you can load data into Spark. And that's mainly for sort of teaching, testing, troubleshooting purposes. And typically you would have a Parquet file or some other sort of cloud storage solution that will give you the bigger data sets. But for now, we can just use Pandas to read the CSV directly from the web. And so I of course already looked at the data structure. The first two columns are dates. And so we basically tell Pandas to parse the first two columns as date time types. So this will take a little time to load. So basically now this is fetching the data set over the network, and it looks a bit like this. So we have 200,000, yeah, almost 300,000 trips, and they're recorded thusly. So you have a start date, you have an end date, duration, you have your station ID, station name, some description, and latitude, longitude of those. This is unfortunately a little bit less verbose than some other. So other bike sharing projects also share data, and they have it a bit richer. So they have, for example, the bike ID. And that's quite interesting because you can play games like which bikes are returned after less than a minute. And that might indicate defects or something like this. So you can play a lot more with this data set. But we'll do two things with this data. So the first one that we'll do is a simple clustering task. And that's just to, you know, stretch our fingers a bit and get used to this Spark environment. So what we'll do is we'll transform this data set such that we have in the columns the hours of the day, and in the rows the days. So each observation is the hourly counts, and then we'll do a clustering on that to see sort of patterns of activity. So that's the warm-up exercise. And then what we basically do is a recommender system. So we'll use the alternating least squares algorithm to get recommendations for, and this is a little bit of a twist on the standard recommender system. So the start stations and the end stations will be our sort of users and items. And so basically the idea is, can we predict with some accuracy where a trip will end given the start station? And then you can, as a homework, try to extend this, maybe given a time aspect to this. So certainly there will be different patterns of movements in the morning, in the afternoon, and maybe for different days. But it's a interesting, at least for those living in Oslo, it's an interesting data set, because you can learn a lot about urban mobility with this kind of data. Any questions to that data set? No. Okay. So then let's get started. So the first thing that we need to do is get this data frame into Spark. And you do that by saying, okay, Spark data frame is spark.create data frame. And you can just pass in this pandas data frame. And with this, you always need to be a bit careful because now we have a Spark data frame. So this could be distributed data. For all we know, this could be a distributed data set of several hundred terabytes or whatever, you know, potentially a very large data set. So whenever you load it to your local machine, you need to make sure that you do some sort of filtering or so before you do it. So this takes a little while to execute. Because this is sort of the first real work that we do in Spark. And this sort of needs to instantiate some local workers and so on. So the first one is a bit slow. And then once you have the Spark data frame, you can do similar things like you can do in pandas. So you can, for example, show the data frame. This is meant to be output on a text terminal, so that's why it ends up a little bit messy. But we see it's basically the same kind of data that we had up here, and Spark clips this at 20 rows exactly to avoid things like you loading millions of rows into a local machine. What you can do is also inspect things like looking at the schema of this data. So we have two timestamps, a long, which is the duration, start station, ends. There's also just what we would expect. So one limitation that we see directly. So if we, for example, let's say we didn't have this duration in here. So if we wanted to select, this is how you get individual columns out. Started at, ended at. This is how we select individual columns. We could also do some basic arithmetics with that. So stf.select. And now if you write something like duration plus 5, let's say, this won't work because it basically doesn't know how to do int plus string. So you need to say, with duration, I actually mean a column of this data set. And you do it just like you would do in pandas. All right, so then you can do basic arithmetics. You can also rename this by saying dot alias longer duration. That renames this new column. So there's a lot of, and unfortunately the Spark documentation is nowhere near as good as the pandas documentation. So yeah, it's the sometimes you need to dig a little bit to find the right functions and the right sort of tricks to do things. And one thing that particularly took me a long time was, so I tried to calculate this duration. So I thought, okay, easy enough. What I do is I get this is the wrong way around, but I take the end time and now I want to do arithmetic. So I need to say, I want this as a column minus the start and show the first 5. Easy enough. So now I actually get this in a nicer format. So now this is really a duration type, 4 minutes, 45 seconds. So this looks quite promising. But if I want to now get this out of Spark and into my PySpark, so I can schema. So this is a interval type. And if I want to get this out, collect the first five. So collect means take the data set and bring it into my local machine. Then I get an error. Then I get an error. And this is because this interval scala data type cannot be translated to Python because the Python interface hasn't caught up with the development yet. So this is just to show you there are things in Spark that are still under active development. So it's a quite bleeding edge tool still. But yeah, so sometimes you run into this kind of errors, and it took me quite a while to figure out sort of what was going on here. So it's basically this whole data set is represented in the worker nodes that's, you know, still on my machine, but it's a Java type, and it cannot translate the type back to Python. But okay, so let's look a little bit. So we have this duration in here. What if I want to do other things than just showing it? Well, what I can, for example, do is say select duration, and now I can do two pandas, which brings this whole data set back into a pandas type. So this is again the duration that came with the data, so it's nothing that I calculate. So this is just one of the types that comes in the data. And now I can do, let's say, histograms on this. So this is actually quite nice. But again, so okay, this is of course typical case. We have some very long durations, some very short durations, and the range is just not covered very, very well on this plot. So what I can say is, basically just let's say we want the durations that are smaller than 120. So take the data frame where the duration is smaller than 120, select the duration. And I get this type of plot. Let's make this 10 minutes. Okay, so this is basic stuff, getting data out, plotting things. Maybe one word of warning, of course, with things like this. So here you see already I get 17,000 points in those buckets. That's not a super small data set. Typically, when I want to do something like this, I would like to say something like a sample. Let's say, give me 10% of this data set, which is much easier for my local machine, right? Again, so this is potentially a very big data set, and I could basically pull potentially big amounts of data on my local node, which might just kill my local Python process. So you know, when you work with Spark, think about data sizes, and you know, you need to at least be a bit aware of that your data resides potentially in a cluster. Okay. But let's work a bit on our data to get again what we want to do is transform this data set into a data set where we have in the rows the individual days. So this should be 30. It's June, so it should be 30 days. Should be 30 days, and then we want the hours and the columns. So how do we do this? Well, let's start by extracting the hour. And for that, we need functions that can operate on the internal types of Spark. So import spark.sql.functions as func. Okay, so let's start with, so I want to add a column, and I do that with column. Call this column hour, and the corresponding function, unsurprisingly, is called hour. This started. So let's look at the first 10 of this. Cannot resolve started at. Okay, sure enough, here the last element that we have is this hour. So this is all at 5 o'clock in the morning, early risers. So those are those trips. So that looks good. The next thing that we of course want to do is get the rows as the days. So then we'll do a group by, and this group by works just like the pandas group by. Let's make this a little bit, because we'll apply a whole bunch of functions, so we'll make this a bit more readable. So we'll group by, and now we need to extract the date of this. And this could be done by a function, but we can also just say started at dot cast as a date. So this will turn this date time into a date. So this will forget about the hour. But we still have the hour as our column, so we're not really losing anything besides the minute and the seconds, which we're not really interested in for this analysis. And let's just for the sake of it count. So this now basically goes and groups the whole data frame by this started at cast as a date. So for each day, we get the daily count. And this is not 100% what we want. So we want the hour. So it forgot about the hour. And to get around that, all we need to do is the original data set, we can pivot it by the hour, and this pivot works just like the standard pandas pivot that we already saw. So dot pivot around the hour. So if you have trouble following this, it's really just what we went through in the pandas session, and there we are. The only thing that I don't like about this is this cast started at as date. So maybe we want to do an alias here, alias date, and there we are. That is our data. So we have these nulls, and that just has to do with the Oslo Bicycle shutting down in the wee hours of the morning. So this already looks quite good. So let's save this as cluster data. This. Okay. So let's just plot this, because this is now not a big data set, right? So it has 24 columns, it has 30 rows, so that's not very big. So that can be safely taken into local memory. So we can say cluster data dot two pandas to plot this. Okay. Now this is not very intuitive really, because so now we plot the hour on the x-axis and the count on the y-axis. So this is not really what I want. So if we look at the data, what I really want is take the date as an index and then transpose the whole thing, because then I plot basically the hourly counts per day. Right, so let's do this. So I say set index date transpose and plot. And then I want this in a bit bigger so that you guys can see what's going on. Okay, here we go. So let's make this actually even a bit wider. Right, so this is now quite interesting. So we have our hourly counts for each day, and we already see quite a rich structure here. So we have the commuting days. So this is probably something like Monday to Friday. This looks much more leisurely. So this is probably kind of weekend traffic, and we can figure this out with some clustering, right? So basically what we want to do is cluster these together. So let's do this. Now there's a restriction in Spark, in that it insists to not work on so if we look at again at our clustering data, this is something that you could use quite easily in something like scikit-learn, but in Spark there's no guarantee that, for example, each row ends up on the same node. So it could distribute the data in the cluster in like non-consistent ways. So that makes it impossible basically to do machine learning on this. So what we'll have to do is we'll have to get our features together into one vector, and this vector is guaranteed to be stored in one place. So let's do this. So from PySpark, so now we need the PySpark.ml package, which is, as the name suggests, contains all the machine learning features on this. And from the feature package, we import the vector assembler. And this is a helper function that will allow us to put all these columns together into one vector. Vector assembler. So we instantiate this class.
I have a question, actually.
Yes, go ahead.
So how easy is it to let's say you want to use Spark for because of the parallelism and cluster support. But let's say you develop stuff with TensorFlow. Is there a connection between the two, or do you have to do it from scratch for Spark?
No, you have to pretty much do it from scratch. But I mean, so you know, TensorFlow is a bad example in a way, because you know, in something like TensorFlow, you really want your data compact in one place in memory, because it's the operations that you do are, you know, involve most of the data. So there, of course, you know, a distributed system where you have, you know, a lot of different nodes to train a neural network, that's a poor choice, because you need a lot of communication, right? So once you're in memory, computers are fast. Once you're out of memory and you need to communicate between two nodes over the network, it's like, okay, order your gravestone, because it's, you know, takes way too much time. But the interface, and you will see this now, for example, with scikit-learn and Spark, they're quite similar, and they are very similar concepts. Like you have pipelines to sort of stitch together operations. You have so that is at least, you know, it's relatively easy to translate the code. It's not one to one, but just the fact that you have interoperability with things like pandas and so on, that is already makes your life much easier.
Yeah.
Yeah, but something like TensorFlow, no, I would not. So that's really a different. If you want a different computational challenge in a way, right? But let's just steam on. What I intend, because if you look at this guy, so for some dates we have nulls in here, and then we have some counts here, and that's a little bit awkward to work with, because at some point vSQL decided, hey, let's extend our service hours. So the correct way to would be, of course, to think about something clever, how to handle those nulls. For now, what I simply say is, take the cluster data, take the NAs and fill them with zero. So this will result in something like this. I'll just stitch in zeros because we're lazy today. So we'll just do it this way. You could, of course, infer something, do something clever here. But for now, let's just override our cluster data with this guy. Now I probably deleted the whole thing, so I need to recreate my cluster data and do this. Okay. Good. So now I can create my vector assembler by just telling it to take so the input columns, and now our columns are basically called 0, 1, 2, 3 and so on. So it's just string I for I in range 24. So that's very easy. And then I can save myself some trouble if I call the output column features. But I could call it anything. If I call it features though, so the machine learning algorithms typically expect there to be a column called features. So that saved me some typing later on. And now we can actually just use our vector assembler to transform our cluster data. As easy as that. Invalid argument exception. Huh. Okay. So we have no 4 o'clock column here. So that's quite interesting. But that's fine. So we can just tell it, okay, there's no 4 o'clock column. So if I not equal 4. So this is a bit interesting. So they didn't extend the service hours to the full set. But now you see what happened here. So we went from these individual columns to a features column with this vector set. Excellent. So now we can start to train our models. So from pyspark.ml.clustering import k-means. So I go from just to explore a few possible cluster sizes, range from 2 to 8. And training. So now I just have training data, right? So I so this is my training data, and then my models are k-means. Where I set the k later. Dot fit on my training data. 4k in case. This now takes a little while, but to me there's really the magic. So to me it's completely transparent. So if my training data now is a several terabyte data set distributed between 100 nodes that sits somewhere in Argentina or on my local machine. It's the same syntax, it's the same stuff. So that's, to me, pretty magical. Adrian, maybe you can comment a little bit there. You asked a question on the chat. Does Spark limit your usage if you use it a lot? What do you mean by that?
No, I mean, if you use computing power, you'd think that they'd be interested in not letting you use too much of it. Like if you put out a lot of really expensive tasks for it, will it ever limit your usage?
In a sort of commercial cluster, so when you run, you know, typically when you use Spark in a, let's say, commercial environment, typically companies have their own Spark clusters, and Equinor certainly does, and have their own means, rent rack space somewhere in the data center that is then used as their Spark cluster. And there you have a prioritization. So some projects have a higher priority to run their tasks. Others have a lower priority. And so it can be that sort of you are limited by, but that's not Spark itself that does it. It's some system administrator that gives you your jobs a certain priority. Just like in most supercomputers, you'll have a sort of rank that and given resources according to that.
Oh, yeah. No, I just thought... I thought that maybe there was some open resources. Like I think with TensorFlow that you can use like GPUs for some of your models, etc.
Yeah, Google does that. So but that's basically Google advertising their own systems and their own cloud environment. So it's not, you know, so Google will give you some GPU power to train models. But that's basically to advertise TensorFlow and to advertise the Google cloud. I mean, so globally, there's, you know, three big cloud providers. There's AWS, there's Google, and there's Microsoft. And then there's sort of also run IBM, Oracle, but they're very, very much smaller. And those companies, they do anything to get you to use their cloud because it's a huge market, it's a huge growth. So there's very fierce competition. So if you just sign up to an AWS account and to a Azure account and to a Google Cloud account, you will get a lot of free stuff. So Amazon has this free quota. You can, you know, use some servers for free. The same in Azure, the same in Google. And this like free use of GPUs is part of Google's sales pitch too. And that's of course then very much directed to data scientists and analysts.
So the best way to test Spark is perhaps just to create a free account on one of those providers and just install Spark on that base.
The easiest is download Java and import, so pip install PySpark and use it on your local machine. So if you want to get a bit familiar with it. And Spark has some sort of introductory tutorials on their webpage that are quite easy to follow. And then I think also in the university library there are several books about Spark. I mean, it's a very popular framework. And of course, if you have trouble, just send me an email. I can also set you up with some resources. So if you look at our models now, so let's grab the first one, models zero. So this is our trained models, and you can look at things like the summary of the, and we'll tell you sort of, what are the cluster sizes? It will tell you what's the training cost, and that's really what we're interested in. It's the inertia, sort of the distances from the cluster centers, and that gives you some idea about the quality of the clustering. But there's of course a lot more in these trained models. Predictions, number of iterations that will run. For this k-means and so on, so without going into too much details, let's plot the you know, let's try to make this default elbow plot to see which cluster size we should use. So we import matplotlib plotlib pyplot splt, and then plot the case versus the m dot summary dot cluster sizes. Sorry.
I have to go. See you.
See you. Thanks for stopping by. Training cost for M in models. Okay. So now we see a bit unusual error plot. So this shows us basically that, okay, anything above three, that's probably not a good idea. So our correct cluster size is probably two or three, right? So we don't know how the drop from zero is, but it's certainly one of those two. And that's to be expected. You know, we have a data set of 30 points. So probably big cluster sizes are not quite interesting. What we can look at now also is the so models 0 and 1, right, corresponding to 2 and 3 clusters respectively, are the interesting ones. So let's look at the cluster centers. So those, and if we plot them, you know, we should get a plot similar to this, that instead of the individual days shows us the centers of the two clusters or three clusters. And the easiest way to do this is make a pandas data frame out of this, transpose and plot it. Right, so now we see, okay, cluster zero, this is this lower activity periods, what we thought, I told you, is maybe more a sort of weekend kind of behavior, so those down here. And the cluster number one is these double peaked kind of commuting hours. We can do the same with our cluster number one, the model number one, which has now three clusters. Yeah, so maybe kind of Saturdays, Sundays, a bit unclear. And again, this double peaked cluster. So there's something, at least some interesting structure that we unveil in this. So let's make a prediction and look at the individual clusters. So let's take this first model and transform the training data. So that's one of the differences between scikit-learn and Spark. So the nomenclature here is transform instead of predict. One thing I should have told you above here when we trained our models. So fit takes a data set and it takes information about what is your features, and if you do supervised learning, what's the labels. And the standard name is features, but as I said here, you could have called this anything else. But if I would have called it anything else than features, I would have had to tell fit sort of what is the column containing the features. So it's a little bit, something to get used to. But else, I mean, it's the mechanics is of course very similar. Okay, so let's look at our prediction data set. So it's basically, you know, just adding a column with a prediction, and that's the cluster number, 0 or 1. Okay. So let's get the predictions out of this. So what I really want to look at, because we were saying, okay, here that's maybe the weekdays, this is maybe the weekends. So I want the day of week. So let's select the And that's again in our PySpark SQL.functions that we call just func. There's the day of week. And that we take from the date column, so the day of week of the date, alias this as a weekday. And then we take our prediction, and instead of prediction, we want to call this cluster. So I say df pred prediction dot alias cluster. So this leaves us with a data set with two columns, the weekday and the cluster. Okay. Now we really would like to see, okay, which weekday ends up in which cluster, how often? All right, so this is really what I'm interested. And you know, as usual, group by comes to the rescue. So we group by the cluster now and the weekday. And we just count. And this gives me the cluster number, the weekday number, and how many of these days end up in that cluster. And now what I can do is, again, put this to pandas. And to now get a nice plot, I need to play with this a bit. I need to pivot it because I want to get a decent bar plot. I need the index to be the cluster, the columns to be the weekday, and the values to be the count. So this is just to get a nice bar plot out of this. Lots. Okay, so this looks quite promising. So our weekday, our Sundays are almost all in this first cluster. One Sunday ended up in here, and then our weekdays are almost all in this cluster number one. And what I suspect is that this zero countdown here is probably because this makes most days lie straight on top of each other. So my hypothesis would be if we would exclude those lower points, we might actually end up with a better prediction. So let's do this. Let's just include those. So if I not in 1, 2, 3, 4. So this now assembles as a data set that doesn't contain these zeros. Let's rerun our models. Look at the new elbow plot. So I'm now including these low counts. And this should make our clusters look a bit nicer. So similar elbow plot. Now beware that this is not the hour anymore because we cut out a bit of data here. Yeah, basically, it ended up pretty much the same, so it doesn't look like it's changing much. But okay, let's have just for comparison, let's look at the model with three clusters. So that's models one. then we have a little bit of a mixed bag. So here there is some Sundays in here, some random weekdays in here. So we took the June data. In June, there's one holiday, which was the 1st of June, which was Pentecost, which was a Monday. So one Monday you would kind of expect to be falsely categorized, but yeah. So if you had to decide on one of those two, you would probably decide on this first model. But again, so it's not so much about, you know, the actual clustering. It's more about showing you sort of the mechanics of Spark and how to go back and forth between Spark and Pandas and plotting things. And I hope that's a good demonstration of this. So let's move on to these recommender systems. So I'm not sure how familiar you are with things like ALS. So ALS is a algorithm called alternating least squares. And the idea is basically you have a matrix M, and you try to find lower rank matrices U and V to represent represent a matrix M with two lower rank matrices U and V. And typically, so if M is a n by n matrix, U will be a k by n and V a n by k matrix. So k being then the lower rank that you want to represent this with. And if you think about a standard recommender system, let's say a Spotify case where you want to suggest artists that people should listen to, so you'll have the users in the, let's say, rows and the artists and the columns, and this lower rank will basically, so this compressed rank will describe sort of tastes, kind of groups of artists, and the values in this V matrix will then describe how strong does one artist belong to that group, and in the U matrix it will basically determine a given user how strong is its taste represented by that grouping. It's a kind of dimensionality reduction, if you want. And we'll use this. So this is again very easy to use. And again more to show you a bit the mechanics of Spark than to explain now in detail how this ALS works. But it's so in general this problem is not convex. So it's hard to solve, but it can be sort of broken up and approximately solved by problems that are in themselves convex, and then come up with a good approximate solution to this. But let's not go into the details of that now. Let's look again at our data set. So we have the start station and end station ID. So basically what I want to predict is, given a start station, how likely are you to end up in an end station? And that was sort of what we effectively do here, is a kind of clustering of the stations. So finding groups of stations that are typically visited from a given start of the trip. So this might be interesting in a setting of planning for infrastructure of bike sharing or a general shared transportation companies. Where should you put if you have a X dollars to invest in new stations, where should you put your added capacity in a most efficient way? Of course, and this is the downside of these recommender systems. This is always given what you know already. So one of the difficult tasks here is, what if you have an artist that has no one has listened to yet, like someone who is new? How do you come up with recommendations for that? And there's active research on, you know, how to include that in predictions here. But that would be a little bit beyond the scope now. But so let's make a data set that basically just contains the start station ID and the end station ID, and how many trips were taken from that station to the other. So we group again by the start station ID and the end station ID. And count. So now a very simple data set, start station, end station, how many trips? And we can have a look at those as well, trips.select. Dot plot dot hist. And you can see so again a lot of the trips, so a lot of the pairs of stations just had one trip. So we should maybe look at where trips count smaller than, we zoom in a little bit. And of course, you will never have zero trips, because then it wouldn't be recorded here. But we see, so there's a lot of counts with small numbers of trips, and then the bigger numbers get exponentially less likely. And this is a sort of typical feature of data sets like this, where you have a lot of stations, and you know, it's probably very unlikely for someone to cross the whole city, but you know, there's always one crazy guy that did it, and that would then end up in this bucket. Okay, so for this we do a train test split, and that's as easy as say random split on our data set, and I give it fractions 0.8 and 0.2. And so what we basically now say is, some of these pairs we take away from the algorithm, and then try to make recommendations and see if those match with what the algorithm predicts. Okay. And since we want to predict on a holdout data set, we need an evaluation. I want to evaluate the counts by how many am I off in my predictions here. And for that, I need a regression evaluator. And I need from the recommendation package, I need ALS. Then again, building the model is very easy. ALS. And then I can set some parameters here if I want. I can say how many iterations should it do. I have a regularization parameter in here, which I can also set. You can read all about that in the documentation. What I need is the user column, and that start station ID in this case, and the item column. So, you know, in the recommender system, you typically talk about users and items, and then you recommend items for a given user. So that's why those names, item column is end station ID. And then the rating column is sort of how strong is the user and the item connected, and that's in our example the count, the number of trips taken. And again, making the models very easy, just fit with the train data. Now this takes a little while, but not a long time, because of course, again, this is not a huge data set, but big enough to be non-trivial, of course. Now we can make predictions, and that's again very easy. Model.transform, remember, transform instead of predict on our test data. And then I need an evaluator. So I use this regression evaluator. And this is very flexible, so I can actually tell him what metric to use. And I want the R squared for this. And again, I need to tell it what the label column is and the prediction column. The prediction column here is prediction. So the model chooses for it naming the column where it stores its prediction. Prediction. So looking at the first few elements of this. So this is the prediction of the count. And you can already see, like, often we're quite a bit off here. So let's have a look at this. And then we need to let it loose. Evaluator dot evaluate. Evaluate on our predictions. Okay. Label column. Okay. Count. Okay, and our R squared is 0.2. Okay, very poor R squared, but at least it tells you, okay, the model is onto something, right? So to use this in a proper production setting, you would probably want a much higher R squared, but as a starting point, not too bad. One thing that we can play with is Basically, this ALS is an iterative algorithm, and it needs some starting values. And you can actually tell it what strategy it should use for the cold start. And we'll use the drop cold start strategy, which is a little bit more advanced than the default, and should give us slightly better results. Stubborn. Section to this, I would like to show you a little bit on how to make predictions or how to give recommendations with this. Instead of just this transform, there's actually quite advanced, more advanced methods for this class of recommendation systems in Spark. So there's actually a lot of different methods that you can use to do recommendation systems, and most of them are implemented in PySpark. So it's actually quite good for building these recommender systems. And to do so, let's first look at the top stations, so the most used stations. And what we do is we take the start station ID and the start station name. And that's basically just for us humans to get a actual label on this and not just a numerical ID. And we just count and we sort descending on the count. And limit this to 10, so the top 10 stations. Right, so this gives us the 10 most used station by count. Okay. So now what we can do is we can tell our model to recommend, and then you can recommend for all items. So what are the users that might like those items? What are the users? What are the items that those users might like? But we can also take just a user subset, and this is now our start stations here, and say for those top stations, give us 10 recommendations each. And this will, for each of those stations, so for example, for station 479, which is Xuhong, it will give us the stations where it thinks the count of the end station should be highest, which count it thinks should that station get. And that's basically, you know, connected to the probability of any given user traveling. So if you start a trip here, that one it thinks is the most probable end station. And then in this vector, there would be more stations. Okay, so let's get one row out of this. And do a bit of plotting. So let's take 10 elements of this and just use the first. So this will give us one row of start station and recommended end stations. And let's make a data set out of this. So the recommended stations data frame is a pandas data frame of the recommendations of this row, row dot. This is again the station ID and the recommend or the count that the recommender system thinks we should expect. To make this a little bit more nice, we can set the column to start station ID and count. To make this look a bit nicer. So now what I want to do is I want to take those and make a plot, and that's just a like little extra. It's not part of the main curriculum, but I think it's useful to know how to deal with a bit of geographic data in pandas. So it's just a little gimmick, so indulge me in this. So what I need to do is I need to now get the latitude and longitude of the of these stations to plot them on a map. So out of my original data set, I select the start station ID, start station latitude and start station longitude. Analysis exception. No. I'm unable to type, so let's just copy paste those guys to make sure. Okay. And now I take them as distinct and two pandas. So lan long lat. So this will give me a data set with the start stations, end station, the start station ID, and the latitude and longitude. And now I can actually join this up with my recommendations, with one exception that I actually need to set the index with start station ID. And this join basically takes the like elements, the same elements of the index of those two data sets. So the recommendation data frame, this guy, and this longitude latitude data frame, and adds the columns together. So it looks a bit like this. For some, I don't have a count because they are not in my 10 recommendations. So, and I can just drop those, drop NA. And that's now my joined data frame. Okay, good. So now we're almost there. There is a very nice package called GeoPandas. And with that, I can make a sort of geographic data frame. And the geo data frame is very similar to the pandas data frame, only that it has a geometry to it. And this geometry is, of course, I mean, you can guess it, our latitude and longitude. So I can extract this from my X and Y coordinates. And those are joint data frame, longitude, and latitude. So this basically generates a data frame with this geometry attached. And then I need to tell it, okay, what are the coordinates? Because geo data is very messy, and the code for latitude longitude points is EPSG 4326. And there's no mystery behind this. It's just how it's named. So it's ISO standard. And now I'm already ready to plot this. So I can say plot and this plots the latitude longitude of those points, and that's a bit unexciting. What I can then use is a package called Contextily, which will give me the map corresponding, so a background map corresponding to these data points. The only thing I need to do if I use this is I need to transform the coordinates on this, because this uses a different reference system, but this is quite easily done. So I take my geodata frame and just transform it to another reference system. And this time it's 38.57, which is the mostly used for sort of web data. And now I can, so if I replot, nothing really changes besides the coordinate reference. But now with this, I can actually say ctx.addBaseMap to this map, to this plot. And that's pure magic. So now all at once, an Oslo map appears and gives me the corresponding points. The only real improvement that I could do is say as my marker size. I can use the count, which will sort of increase the marker size on where I find it's most relevant. So yeah, that's the end of this short discourse. Yeah, we did a bit of geographic stuff towards the end to just round off this recommender system. So we got our recommendations out. So the counts of trips that the system thinks should be taken from the station, which is 479. It's Sjuholmen. So this is somewhere around here, and the most commonly used stations from this is here, which is close to the closest subway stop. This I actually don't know. This is probably where the ships leave and the beach. So it's a quite interesting data set to play with. And yeah, that is all I had. So we have already one who left who wasn't interested in the whole geographic. But Adrian, do you have any more questions to this?
No, I'd just like to mentioned that I really enjoy your sessions, and I'm very surprised that more people aren't attending them. But
So I think this is a function of, you know, the times. I had a master student who actually had to, you know, pause his master thesis because of Corona and family and so on. So I think a lot of people, you know, don't have much patience and time these days. And then I think, so the problem with this online teaching is really that you never know how many people just watch the uploaded lectures. So I had several students actually write me like, hey, can you upload the session because I would like to watch it. So I think that makes it a bit difficult to actually, you know, gauge true attendance. I don't know, Christos, do we get watch counts on the videos?
I don't have watch counts on this. I used to have it on YouTube, then I had watch counts. I think the main problem is that sometimes I want to do something interactive, and if I do it at the end of the session, then some people will have left already. And then, it doesn't work very well. I mean, what people need to know that there's going to be interaction, they show up. So when I had QA sessions last week, then everybody showed up.
Sure.
But if it's going to be a lecture, they can just watch the video.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I don't mind too much, to be honest. So if some people think it's useful, then that's good enough for me also.
Yeah, I mean, if people don't ask questions, then it doesn't make any difference. But you should be asking questions, typically. And I got people to answer questions easily on the on live performance, let's call it. But you can somehow do the same with breakout rooms. A little bit, I did once breakout session.
Yeah.
But then I had a breakout session, then one of the breakout rooms was people that didn't actually do anything. They were actually logged on, but they were not on the computer.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's a special time, and you know, it's, I think it's also important to be understanding of, you know, people's situations, and yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, so then I want to talk about the exams a little bit. I'm trying to make this online exam. I will share myself now. Okay, if I can. So I'm trying to use Inspera right at this point. I haven't actually managed to make it work yet. But this is the actual exam, how it's going to look like. And this is the old exam. And it could be maximum 10 questions. And typically there are some multiple choice questions that have only 1 point. And there are going to be a couple of questions which are simple calculations, some knowledge questions like this one, causality, what kind of variables do we have here, what are covariates, and so on, and some other simple calculation questions like this one, and another a question that is more about the we have to synthesize an answer more carefully. It's a word problem, essentially. And another word problem that's a bit more complicated. Yeah. So I think in this particular exam, I had 3 word problems and 5 very short questions. So it's going to be a similar mix, maybe 2 word problems and 6 word short questions, typically. Yeah. So a couple of 1 point questions, a couple of 4 point questions, and the rest 2 point questions. Right. So then the other thing I want to mention is that there was already the projects. If you go to the project here. So project 2 has 2. Let's see. So, Adrian, you should be able to see project 2, right? And there are 2 things to do here. So the first one is what we call a medical project. It's the same as last year. All the data is already in there. And there are different attributes. Some of them are interesting attributes, like fixed attributes like sex and smoker and genes, and some of the attributes are not permanent, it's like kind of symptoms, right? And then here we have some actions and some outcomes, and the historical data, they have already the actions and the outcomes in there, and the whole point of the exercise is to be able to use the existing data to figure out something about how different actions or different affect outcomes, and how different and how this depends on the genes and what systems they have. Now, because you need to take new actions to find out what's going on, basically you need to have a simulator. You cannot say, I will take another action now and see what happens, right? So it's not a classification problem. So in the first part, you basically look at the data, try and see which treatment seems better of the 2 treatments that they have. And in the second part, you have to find a policy that, depending on the symptoms, gives a different treatment. So here you just try and find what's the best action without taking into account the input. In the second part, you find a policy that depends only on the current observation. And you need to try and find what the utility of the policy is from the data you have already. You can try and build a simulator. You can run use a simulator as well. Okay. So the simulator actually tells you what is actually happening there. So you can use a simulator to try and generate new data, or essentially to try and test your policy on new patients. But the important thing here is that when you measure the utility on the historical data, you don't really know what happened in the past. You cannot just plug in a patient and see what will have happened. You have to use some kind of model or import something to estimate the utility, like we discussed yesterday. And if you can, you can try and provide error bounds on the utility. And the last part of the most complicated one is, if you have a policy, then you might want to think about an adaptive policy that changes its recommendations as it gets more data. You can do that by just using the historical data, or you can try and use the data that comes in to try and find better and better policies. Now, the problem with this particular example is that you only have, you have a lot of actions to take potentially, and you have quite a lot of users. So it's very, very hard to find the optimal action to take for any given patient, because the patients are so different and varied, and there are so many things you could do, that finding the optimal action will take a long time. So you can't find a suboptimal treatment for most patients, or for some types of patients, to work pretty well. Yeah. So this is the exercise four here. Yeah. So if you want to do this project, it's fine. Before, it's not very difficult. It tells you exactly how you do it. Now, if you're feeling more adventurous, then there's this project. Now, the project is different because here you first take a look at this one. It's called ML Fairness Gym. And the whole point of the Fairness Gym is that you have an agent that is taking actions, and it's interact with some kind of environment. The environment, think about as people that are coming in to receive treatment, and you observe their symptoms, and then you take an action, and something happens. Now, the environment can be dynamic or it can be not dynamic. It shouldn't make a big difference in this particular case if you're talking about patients, because the patients, well, they come and they go, and a new patient comes in, and what you do to one patient doesn't affect another patient. So you shouldn't really consider about how the environment changes itself. But you should really think about what happens to each individual that you consider. And in this setting, they have a couple of problems. One is the lending problem, where you have different groups and they have different credit scores, and you want to decide what action, whether to give credit to the people from different group depending on the credit score. Now, the thing is that in this particular setting, you affect the environment somehow, because if you give credit to specific people from a group and they return the credit, then the credit score will increase. Right. So this will become somehow affect the environment. But you should think about it not as affecting the environment, you should think about it as affecting your model about the different groups. Now they have a couple of other settings here. We have one on social networks, but if you look at the papers, at this thing here is a bit easier to look at. So have a couple of agents, a couple of environments, and a couple of experiments. Okay, so the main thing to look at is, for example, this one, let's say college admissions. So this is all Python, and they have agents and the environments. The agent is basically what you implement, and the environment is what is fixed. And have a bunch of metrics that they use to measure stuff. And metrics can be essentially how well you're doing in terms of who you're admitting, and then maybe there's another metric that's about fairness. So you can add metrics as you like. Here you just use the fixed metrics that have in this experiment. So the scenario, set up the agents, and you see there are a bunch of different, there's a specific type of college admission jury that they use, robust jury, and the naive jury, and the fixed jury. So they have different environments, different agents that they try. And depending on what you plug in here as a parameter, right? So there's a parameter that they set up. And then run the experiments and it kind of works. So if you want to play around with this, It's going to take quite a bit more work because you have to try and figure out some things for yourselves. It's not my code. But I think it's kind of worthwhile to try it out if you feel like stepping outside your comfort zone. Okay. If you have questions about these environments and how it works, then take a session next week, let's say half of the sessions on Wednesday, to go further with it. But for this week, you basically only like have to look at one of these problems, try and analyze what happens at high level, and try and have a first stab at using the code that exists already. And that's it. Okay, so basically that's it for the project and the exam. So I'm thinking next year to have OpenAI Gym introduced a bit earlier than this. But I'm not sure if it's a good idea. So that's why I'm introducing this as an elective project this year to see if people are taking it up and if they can actually find it simple enough. I don't think it's very difficult, but the documentation of OpenAI Gym is a bit sparse, so I don't know.
Well, I'll certainly look at it. That seems quite interesting.
I mean, it is interesting, but I don't know if it needs a bit more time to get into because you have to read essentially the paper and see what they're doing and how they're doing it to understand how you can use these environments. I don't know if we'll keep it like this. So next year, maybe I will actually change the simulator I have now to be in the OpenAI Gym framework. And then the students can use the same framework for both project aspects. The difference is in the old project, I had a lot of detailed instructions of what to do at every step.
Yeah, maybe we can come up with something similar.
Anyway. But yeah, for next week, you should basically decide what your project is and give a high-level description of it.
And then also I wanted to again make the announcement. I mean, it's on the course page already, but for next week I arranged a guest lecture or two guest lectures actually. So two of the data scientists at Equinor will come and talk. So one will talk about like one AI problem, which is deep learning on seismic data. Handling uncertainties and so on. And then the second one is actually a quite interesting talk by someone who used to work before at DNVGL, and they're looking at assurance of AI systems. So what do you do if you take AI to, you know, do maintenance on a system where a failure might mean multiple deaths, and how do you arrange AI systems in a high stakes environment sort of? And I think it's going to be a interesting talk.
Cool.
Good. Then, if there are no questions, let's end the session.
Bye. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Have a good one.
All right. You too.